Welcome to the Dirt Bike Burrito Podcast. My name is Jeremy, and thank you so much for joining us for this third and final installment of our interview with Scott Britnell. It has been epic, and in this episode, we dive deeper into his completion of the Dakar Rally. We also find out what he does to his 450 KTM Rally after he gets it. It's crazy. It's a perfect bike. Why are you touching it, Scotty? But he does. He does. Thank you so much, Scott. It's been an absolute privilege to take us and our listeners on this amazing journey. We appreciate it. We really hope that next year that we can either be a part of one of your crazy rides that I've seen floating around, or at least sit down with you and talk about your potential 2022 Dakar attempt. We know ourselves plus the listeners are super keen to hear more of your stories as well. Once again, massive thank you to our supporters, Grassroots Hard Enduro. So their dates are obviously out for the 2021 season. Make sure you go check them out. I know we've already signed up for a whole bunch of them. So that could be a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, if you want to make sure that you're not going to lose, enter the ones that we've entered, because that's where we are. We're at the back. Make sure you go check them out. B&B Off-Road, obviously, if you're going to do hard enduro, you need B&B. I mean, goes hand in hand, like Dirt Bike Burrito and speakers. Yeah. Global Racing Oils. Once again, we've been putting hours on our bikes, and we love the GRO stuff. Make sure you keep your bikes well lubed through this hot period, especially Christmas. We all get a little heavier after Christmas, so your bikes need a little bit more love to get our fat asses around the tracks. Acherby's Australia. That's right. It's Christmas time. Better gifts, Acherby's. Plus, Jezza could do with a few nice things. So if you want to send the Dirt Bike Burrito Boys some Christmas presents, Acherby's is the place to go. Goat Mountain Extreme Clothing. Now, I will always say that I love the Goat Mountain Extreme bright yellow jumpers. Not everyone's a fan, but I'm a fan. So make sure you go check out their other stuff, because it is absolutely awesome. I can't wait to see what the crew put out in 2021. Next Adventure and Ride ADV. Now, Ride ADV have released their dates for 2021, so make sure you go check them out. Once again, we'll be at a few of those events, which is going to be absolutely awesome. Frontline Safari is another one, which they're linked to, which is a previous guest, Clay. So make sure you go look at that page. We will be there. We will also be bringing a few special guests, so make sure you go and check that out. Follow that. Follow Next Adventure and Ride ADV. Follow all the people that are supporting us. Also, make sure you go follow the guests as well. I mean, they're going to be releasing some cool stuff next year, so make sure you go check them all out. I'm super keen to see what's going to happen in 2021. So, until then, enjoy your Christmas, enjoy the episode, keep riding, and stay safe. Cheers.
Welcome to the Dirt Bike Burrito Podcast. Each episode, the crew will be talking with riders, organizers, and supports in the off-road motorcycle scene. From desert racing and hard enduro to flat track and trials, a little bit of everything rolled into one, a Dirt Bike Burrito. Follow us and stay up to date with upcoming guests on our social media pages and wherever you get your podcasts. Also, just a heads up, these boys and girls are passionate about what they do. Some bad words could jump out throughout the episode. So sit back in your car or crank your workout to the next level and enjoy.
Right, so when you first got your KTM 450 Rally,
yep.
What did you do to it? Did you just ride it as it was, or did you already have like a bit of knowledge of what to change?
So even when it comes from factory ready to race, you've still got to add the navigation gear, right? Yes, you can plug it in, plug and play sort of thing, but just fitting that, maybe putting a decent seat on it. You know what? The cost of some of the components on the bike was the first place I started. I even invested more money in cheaper parts. Like a different exhaust system.
Really?
Yeah, at half the price, just so that if I destroyed that, then I would at least still have, the original.
Original one.
Yeah.
Right, okay, yep.
You know, you need a spare set of wheels for it. I actually took the engine out straight away and took it down to a guy in Sydney, and he polished and ported the head.
Wow.
Right.
Do you buy this new?
Yep.
Brand new, so you're pulling a brand new motor out.
Yep. Got the head polished and ported.
Okay.
Flowed. Flowed.
Flowed is the term, is it?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, right.
So that was not for more performance.
No.
That was just to, in the hope to make it smoother,
okay,
and run better.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
Not run as hot. And yeah. Knowing the rally teams, or the rally support teams that are out there, they don't touch a thing when it comes to the engine. I don't know, it was just something that I thought, something that I did on my Husky rally, or Husky enduro bike before I sent it over, and that thing has only just failed after 450 hours.
Right.
So, and that's without touching piston
rings.
And
that's in rally condition too. That's not
a fair bit of flogging.
That's not like just going across a Simpson or whatever. This is rally condition.
Correct.
Because, I mean, if you think about 450 Ks, you're like, oh, that's not that.
Hours.
You're like, oh, that's, you know, I mean, you would, you'd probably do that in 4 years, but, you know, just by your riding capacity, but that's hard riding.
Yep. So, I did quite a bit, mate.
Okay.
You know, I had a set of, I guess, factory quality forks. Mm-hmm. I had a set of white power Convel forks.
Yep.
Was
out of the TM? Were they the same?
They were out of the Husky that I'd bought.
Oh, the Husky.
Originally, they were out of a KTM 690 rally, I think. Fitting those up, which changes your triple clamp. You have to have that, and then just simple shit.
Yeah,
you know, drilling holes in shit, lock wiring things so that, you know, that one widget bolt doesn't let you down. All of that.
No alloy radiators.
No.
Lesson learned.
KTM rallies are just one big fuck off radiator though.
It is.
Curve.
An oil cooler on top. Yeah. So there's a classic. They do fail, you know, if you have a big accident, you could have the radiator fail or the oil cooler that sits on top of the radiator fail. Just something as simple as getting a hydraulic line so that you can bypass that oil cooler if it shat itself, you know.
Okay.
And having a couple of banjo bolts to be able to bypass it totally.
Yeah.
Just to keep yourself in the race.
Yeah.
Just go into that sort of level of detail.
Yeah.
You know, because it was always my aim to go Malmoto.
Yeah.
You know, bomb-proofing it and knowing the bike backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I did to it.
Yeah, okay.
And then
packed
it up, put it on an aeroplane and sent it to Europe.
Yep.
Where one of the rally teams received it in Europe, put their eye over it because you just don't have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that might have that experience in Australia are probably trying to put money away for their next race.
Yeah, right.
As opposed to reach out and help.
Yeah.
So shipped it over to Europe. They looked at it and went, the fuck did you do this for? You've done this wrong. I'll fix that for you. Yep, no worries.
Okay.
And I'll charge you for it. And then I'll see you at the start line.
Yeah.
So, shipped it off in November. It went on the boat in France in December and I met it in South America.
Yeah, right.
Yep. So
for the race in 18? For the race in 2018?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So, which was the 40th edition.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the second last in South America.
South America, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it was Peru, Bolivia, Argentina.
Yeah, okay.
Special.
Yep.
Special, 40 years of it.
Yeah,
awesome. Well, from all accounts, they made it a little harder. It's the only hard one they've ever run, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The rest were just warm-ups.
Yeah.
So, it was good.
Yeah.
And again, probably like running the canning, like having a crack at other things, I hadn't afforded myself to go and have a look at Dakar, you know, to see the intricacies of how it runs. So I was blind to everything when I got there.
Much riding prep before you went?
I tried, but the whole, you know, the farm and... Yeah, I got more in than I would normally.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, that's just out at bloody Belanglo State Forest for a couple of hours at a time. Nothing big and nothing terrain specific.
Are you doing fitness, like PT, like you know, gym training or anything like that? Like, because you can't get the bike training?
Yeah. Again, not as much as I'd like to have done. It's just bloody life gets in the road.
Yeah.
You know? So, enough. I had just hoped enough. So, I flew into Peru, flew into Lima, a week early. So, I left Boxing Day a week before most people and went straight up to Cuzco, which is at 10,500 feet, I think.
Wow.
So, because the rally was going to go up through Bolivia, was going to get to some serious altitude, I went over there a week early just to be at altitude and do a bit of fitness stuff and try and try and improve the oxygen levels in the blood.
And is this stuff that you've taken from the military? Is this
that's one.
I was about to say, you're not on a Honda XR on this. You're on a bit better bike. So
no, I'm just thinking more the knowledge of what your body has to go through at those heights.
I have suffered from altitude sickness before.
What's that like?
It's debilitating. Like it's a nauseating headache that you can't just put it aside and push through it.
Right.
You can take on some drugs, preventative drugs. But if it hits you, it's hard work to fight through it.
Right. Okay.
You
know,
it's annoying. Like when I went into Cuzco, the first day and a half in a hotel room, coming from sea level to 10,500 feet, you've got a mad headache just sitting in a hotel room.
Yeah, okay.
You know, where you can take a Panadol or you can take the drugs to sort of reduce it, then put that in the race environment where you're fatigued and dehydrated, and it's only going to compound it. So,
and you're focused too, you're concentrating too, you're trying to,
and then things go wrong.
It. Yeah.
The terrain challenges you, you're struggling, and it carried through. You know, I still suffered from the altitude because a week's not enough, but it was an effort, you know.
Yeah.
So spent a week there and then went back down to Lima and received my bike and went through that huge stressful process of getting your bike scrutinized, making sure everything's tight, picking up my tyres off the people that got them over there for me, having to lubricate the moose ahead of time, put them in the tyres, wrap them up in glad wrap so that they wouldn't be full of dust and dirt from the trip, you know, all of those things down in Lima. You know, it's bloody 40 degrees. It's hot.
You know,
Mel Moto's a different story. Or, you know, they give you a hanger.
Yeah.
And you've got your one trunk, and then you have to try and do all this shit, get your bike scrutineering without any advice. You know.
Yeah.
You've got nobody there to sort of mentor you through it and that sort of thing. Yeah. So, quite stressful.
Yeah.
And turning somehow, just that whole process, already turns into 12-hour days.
Mm.
So it's not like rip down and do a few things and then back to the hotel room to recover and just prepare yourself mentally.
Yeah.
Just stressful the whole way.
Yeah.
I had to hunt. Even though I'd managed to get my tyres there through a crew, they weren't in a position to be able to carry all my tyres. So then I'm running around the bivouac trying to find somebody that, one, speaks English, two, has the capacity, isn't stressed out themselves enough to be able to, you know, talk through, can you carry my tyres? Why would I do that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Scotty, well, can you carry my tyres for me?
When
you got your bike back from the crew that prepared it, did you see stuff and go, oh, makes sense, why didn't I think of that?
No, it was minuscule shit.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was them just rerouting wiring
based
on their experience and that kind of thing. Okay. So it wasn't anything major.
You didn't look at it and go, fuck, why did I miss that?
Not really.
Yeah.
And that was why I had the prudence to send it to them. Having a bit of rapport with those guys in the prior. Baz Dakar.
Right, okay.
Okay. What did they do for me? I'm trying to think where I came across them before that. No, in fact, that was a blind decision based on a recommendation from somebody else to use them. A Dutch company. They all speak good English. You know, good reports.
Yeah, right.
And ring up. If I send my bike, can you receive it and sort it out? Yep, no worries at all. You know, simple as that.
Mm.
And in that sort of rally community, it's all it takes.
Yeah.
You know, you prove yourself to be a dickhead thereafter, you know, you won't get that support. But,
yeah, absolutely.
They understand full well how hard it is to, you know, to play in the Dakar or in the rally world. Yeah. And they appreciate that coming from Australia is about as far away as you can get, you know, to come. So it's pretty cool how they jump on board and help you out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So day one, rally day, first day, what's it like? Are you nervous? Are you excited?
A bit of a bogus day for that rally. Massive podium.
Yeah.
Star.
Yeah,
you're a rock star.
Yeah.
You pay good money, but you're a rock star for a day.
Yeah.
You know, get up there and pats on the back and it's all great. It's a breath of fresh air and relief from the stress of getting through scrutineering and everything.
Yep.
Now it's just get on the bike and put your helmet on and away you go. So a ride off the podium, the start podium, through the streets, There's millions of people around, you know, lining the first 150 k's of the highway, and all that shit. And then, you know, and then the first reality was following another guy on a bike down the freeway, at, you know, in traffic at the 40 k's an hour because there's so much traffic, you know, there interested in the rally, watching that other guy in front of me go straight up the arse end of a car that pulls up in front of him and he breaks his wrist.
Oh my god, what the fuck?
So I think he got 58 kilometres into a road ride to the prologue.
Tyres hadn't hit sand.
No. Ran up the arse end of a car, broke his wrist, and zero refund. There is nothing. Nobody's going to give you anything back.
Oh, that's just
so
enormous. That is where the term heartbreak has been formed from.
I think he worked out that it was about €2,500 per kilometre of Dakar. Mm. It was sad. Anyway,
was he Australian by any chance?
No, I can't remember where he was from, to be honest. Anyway, that was like a reality check right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fucking, you know, it's another 14 days to the finish. Stay focused.
Don't get
wrapped up in the fanfare. And
well, we have the heard hype. That the liaison stages are usually the most dangerous stages of the rallies because there's
can be.
Yeah, like I think they were talking to Fergo, James Ferguson. Yeah. He was talking about one of his mates made it all the way to the end, finished the Dakar, then was riding back from the finish line and got hit by a car. Like.
Yep.
Made it all the way through and then got hit.
Yeah.
Like, it's the liaison, and I think you listen back to Todd and Jake Smith. Todd was saying that, the most dangerous days were the 450 k's or something.
Liaisons.
Yeah, they had to go between, like, because they had to, with, like, mountain passes. Like, it was more dangerous to path to get back to the bivouac than the actual rally that he'd done.
Yeah, and you're a bit lawless.
Yeah, like tired. You're fatigued. You know, you can get as the other guys are saying. They kind of get just a little bit brain dead from it all because they're just sitting on a highway doing 100, 110, 120.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched a guy. So we were at altitude. It was cold on the way into, I think Bolivia, and it was getting late in the afternoon, and he just missed a corner and rode straight into the barricading. You know, on a sweeper, not at over speed, but just fatigue, just sort of lost focus on what he was doing, and ran straight into the barricade, and over the barricade he went. You know, which, you know, it hurt. He bunged himself up a bit, but he got back on and was okay.
Yeah.
But it happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. But
before we keep going on, sorry to do this, bring you back. When you're packing, you're saying when you do Melimoto, you have a crate. That's your life. Like, that's for the next 14 days. This is pretty much what you can do outside of scavenging and picking things from other teams.
Yep. So,
how do you prepare that box? I guess
a fair bit of second guessing.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that gets your military background and help you understand how to prep, like,
yep,
a lot of things in a small area as well.
Correct. Now, I didn't even get that box until I got to the start line because all the Europeans would have picked it up when they did scrutineering and put their bikes on the boat. I just went over with all that gear in a box on the plane. So I didn't get to... Some guys go to great lengths of having their individual sockets sort of sitting in foam in the top and, you know, being able to work out what spares fit and how to jam as much in as you can. The reality is it's not quite like it used to be. So because I committed to a rally bike meant that I could pay another €1,500 and walk over to the Dakar parts truck and buy any part on site that I needed.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
So, but that, there's no guarantees they're going to have it.
Have the part, yeah.
You know, so you want to cover off on most things, but then there's a cost relation. You know, I don't want to put a whole new front fairing and, you know, that carbon fiber in my box and bulk it out. You know, it's $15,000 worth of carbon fiber. Yeah. So I don't want to buy it unless I need it, sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So,
duct tape will hold that thing together for as long as it can.
So finances will determine what goes in the trunk to a certain degree.
Right.
And then just your consumables for day-to-day.
Yeah.
And let's say a chain and sprockets for the halfway day. You know, fresh brake pads is needed. Those sorts of things.
Food and things like that in there as well?
Not in the trunk, mate.
Yeah.
Generally just consumables, parts, tools.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, you get a gear bag.
Yeah.
You know, so one riding gear bag. And that's, yeah, well, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
You know, and your tyres are off to the side. So, yeah, you do kind of live out of that trunk and a gear bag. So, not so much food, but, you know, your snacks for on... If I did it again, I'd have a whole lot more. But, yeah, nutrition plan is kind of backed up by your bag and your spare... Yeah, I did take spare jocks on that one.
Good.
Yeah, a couple sets.
Oh, yeah, good. That's what I was hoping. That's where my questions were leading. Hopefully, yeah, a couple of jokes. How many boots, how many helmets are you taking?
So I did take a spare complete helmet.
Yep.
Goggles? Yeah, a couple of sets of goggles.
Yep, gloves?
Yep, different lenses. Yeah, a couple of sets of gloves. So just two complete sets of riding gear.
Yeah, like a wet weather, warm gear.
One rally jacket for the cold weather and one for the... You know, warm weather.
Yep.
So one that sort of was just mesh, and allowed a lot of airflow.
Yeah.
For down in Argentina, where it, you know, the year before got to close to 50 degrees. So yeah, you kind of can't have a one suits all, and then you've got to rely on having a good spill and tearing one apart. So trying to have a little bit of redundancy where you could. So yeah, all of that stuff. But spoke to Rod Faggeter, in the lead up, and he sort of suggested if I could find somebody to carry a spare helmet, to certainly do that. So I had a spare peak and, you know, some pads for the helmet that I was going to use, but also had a complete spare. So I didn't let me down there.
And like boots and things like that, you just one pair of boots and...
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Do you run knee braces or anything
like that? I do, mate. Yep. Yeah. I had gear fail on me. You know,
okay.
Like you ride all year on a set of knee braces, no dramas whatsoever.
Mm.
You get over there and 5 days into it, the critical little screw that holds the pivot point into your knee brace disappears. You know, you don't notice.
No.
You take your boots off that night,
it
falls out of your bloody gear and it's gone. So then you've got a knee brace that's probably more of a liability than it is when you do have buggered knees. You know, buddy, boots that you take over new so they don't fail, and then you lose the top of all your toes because they weren't broken in. And there's sand, there's sand in everything, so there's sand in your socks and shit that's grinding your toes away. It's like, and I took those boots because they were the top of the range, had the most protection that I could get.
Yep.
Should have gone with the next level down that were far more comfortable and they break softer, in easier and a little bit softer.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, how many times do I need to learn that lesson? Twice now.
Do you wear things like those air jackets, those hit jackets or those inflatable ones? That's part of part of this year's...
That's this year's, or, yeah. It wasn't, mate,
wasn't back then?
No, and that's a story. Shit, we've been talking for long enough, but that's a story that takes me back to when I... had my big crash in The Simpsons.
The next story after that, we're going to get to that big crash.
Right, well, let's come back to air jackets
Okay, so yeah, done.
I didn't run an air jacket on the rally.
No.
You know what? I compromised there. You've got to get all your gear through scrutineering. And I ran the soft Liat-type body armour, soft armour. And I went to the point of pulling out about 50% of those foam layers out of that. Just and drilled a shitload more holes in it to let airflow through.
Yeah,
at the sacrifice of the level of protection that it provided. But cooking myself in the dunes was more of a concern. And
yeah, of course.
You know, I just relied on myself riding at a pace that was realistic for me to avoid that sort of risk. If I'm going to hit something hard, wouldn't matter what I had on, short of an air vest.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So talking of the dunes... Were they everything that you'd imagined? Was the 2 years prior practicing at Katana's Run, were you ready for what you saw?
No. I mean, I think as a single sand dune, what is in the Middle East and what is in North Africa is bigger.
Yeah, okay.
But it's funny, the geography is what creates those dunes in South America, particularly in Peru. When you're on those dunes, you can see the coast, and it's all the coastal sand and the wind that blows up into the massive mountain valleys there, and it just accumulates, and it almost becomes as high as the mountains themselves.
Right.
You know, so if you were standing at sea level, you could look up about 15 k's in front of you, and those dunes are, they're almost a kilometre high.
Jesus.
But they're not an individual
sand
dune. In fact, they're over a kilometre high.
Yeah.
So they put you in these sand dune systems, and a comparison with DC and the rest of the Middle East, you get a big dune, you drop off it, and you line yourself up and you go for the next big dune.
Right.
These, you climb a big dune, it levels out, and then you go again.
Yeah.
You go into a pocket, and it's just, that's the depth of it sort of thing. There's less downhill rest.
Yeah, okay.
And I think racing in DC is in winter time because over 50 degrees in the Middle East is unrealistic.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
When you do Dakar in South America, it's in the summertime.
Yeah.
So the temperature change is different, and the sand can be a whole lot more fluffy.
Oh, okay.
You know, and it's softer and it's powder.
Yeah.
So just the size of the dunes would be okay.
Yeah.
The fact that they're soft and fluffy, just a nightmare.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
right.
No.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's certainly, I contemplated trying to go places and get dune time here. And I think the only place really, there's a few places in Australia, but none that are in close proximity to me here.
Right.
And it was just going to be a massive effort to get to. So I've, you know, let it slide and sucked it up.
Yeah. Mate, you've got a sand arena back there, mate. Just go dump a whole bunch of sand in there and just ride around.
Yeah, no, I get my ass kicked and start a bike up here.
If you have to push it down the road before you start it.
Something like that.
Yeah, I could imagine. Yeah. But, all right, so let's your day one. Let's go day two.
Well, day one was ended in a prologue.
Yeah.
You know, a transit down liaison and then prologue. A lot of people had an issue on... It's not a true representation of who's who in the zoo, but I ended up finishing 25th in the prologue, ahead of where I should have been because I followed the right people and didn't get lost and didn't miss a waypoint that I had to go back to. But anyway,
how long's the prologue?
Oh, it was only about a 30k loop.
Okay.
Yep. Survived that.
Mm-hmm.
Others didn't. Others wrote themselves off on the first big dune.
I think there's footage of that as well.
You see, yeah, I was just going to say, mate. Yeah.
That was a massive drop off.
I remember seeing that as
sailed off.
Oh yeah,
it hurts.
Yeah, yeah,
that, yeah. From going at 100 miles an hour to going to zero, like 20 meters below, I think people need to go back and find that footage and try and find it.
Yeah, day two was good though. Started way ahead of where I should have been, within the field, which is okay. Went well.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing went out of the, you know, nothing hurt. Didn't break anything. So it was good. It was a good day. It was a good full day. It was quite challenging. And, you know, it was an fairly easy day. I think we'll finish riding by 3:30. No dramas. So I had a full... It allowed me to step through my planned daily routine. Okay. You know, get in daylight service, get a feed, go through the road book and get ready for the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It was fairly uneventful.
Okay.
Day three was the same.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's fairly good results. Happy with my riding in those first 3 days. Come off the end of the special on day three. And, you know, before you do the mad liaison, long liaison back to the new bivouac, sitting there having a drink of water, look down and my left-hand fork chrome leg had come unscrewed at the bottom.
Oh.
So all I could see was the fork internals, the bottom of my left-hand fork.
Oh, right.
There's fucking oil everywhere. I'm just going, oh, this has never happened before. You can't put a bolt on those things to tighten them up. And I had bought a brand new, not a brand new, I had bought another set of super expensive Convel forks that I put on the front from an Italian guy that I knew who's got way too much money. And I think he had used them on his enduro bike and had changed the bottom boots on the fork legs.
Yep.
He told me he had them serviced by White Power Italy, which is fine, I believe him.
Yeah.
But in changing that out, that one may not have been done up tight because you wouldn't Loctite it. Because when you do need to undo it, you can't damage the chrome leg and stuff. And it's come undone. I'm going, oh, fuck, what do I do about this? Can I even ride it the way it is? You know, and it's a mad long, really fine thread. And so in the end, I pushed it down and did it up a bit. And so then it looked like it was functioning the way it should, but I knew that the fluid had gone. And I'm riding down the road and the factory teams, their trucks, they have vehicles that meet them at the end of their rally and they get dressed up like soft cocks with all their winter clothing so that they're recovering between there and the bivouac, you know, because that's what they do.
Yeah,
they try to preserve as much, conserve as much as possible. Anyway,
look, they're valuable entities, my friend. You've got to look after them.
You don't see the footage of the way they dress them for the liaisons.
No, I bet.
No, absolutely not.
You know, they put those big puffy things on the handlebars to keep their hands warm. And
oh, like the farmers.
Yeah, all right. That shit. And good on. Yeah. Good on them. That's the game they play.
They put a little shower cap over Toby Price to keep his mullet on there nice and dry as well. Make sure it doesn't go froofy and all.
So I had good rapport with one of the factory mechanics that I'd known in the past. I saw him there and I turned around and doubled back and just got some advice at a critical time before I did 300 km of highway. And he basically gave me, a dry set of gloves to be able to manually tighten it as best I could. And he, you know, his experience was stop every 10 minutes and make sure that stays done up, because as soon as you damage the thread in there, if it isn't already, you know, that's a $15,000 set of forks that are screwed and you have to run around and find another set, you know?
Yeah.
So I did, you know, and in the end, reality was I stopped about every 30 km because, you know, it was a long run.
Yeah.
Got in. And that's where life kind of, that's where Dakar threw its first real challenge at me. I had a fork, like I got in at 8 o'clock that night. It was a long day. So I was already way behind, as was the rest of the field. Got off the bike, I serviced the bike. I ran down to the team that had looked after my bike and got it to the start line. Said, this is what's happened. Can I get some fork oil off you? How much do I need to put in? You know? He told me, you know, he sort of said, whatever it was, 380 mils of fluid is enough to fill it. Righto, ripper. And I went back and I made the fatal mistake trying to conserve time by not even taking the fork out of the bike.
Right. Okay.
I just unscrewed the top, made sure that bottom was done up. And that was no dramas because I had the tool to do that properly.
Yeah, okay.
And just poured in the 380 mils of fluid in the top of the fork and then worked it in. What I didn't realise was that even though that thread, it was fully exposed, because of the different chambers in the fork, there was still a shitload of oil in the... a shitload of fluid in the fork that hadn't drained out. I just made the assumption that it was bone dry. So when I put 380 mils of fluid in, I probably had more like 520.
Right.
You know, and...
Wow.
And because of the fatigue factor, I did that up. You know, I pumped the forks with my hands a couple of times and let it flow through to get the air out of where it shouldn't have been, and went, right, I'd move on, prep for tomorrow, do the service, do your road book, and go to bed. I got up the next morning, and it was a beach start the next day, so it was a short liaison of about 45 km, five or six of it which was off the highway to get into the beach. It was fine, you know, down the highway, no dramas. As soon as I got off the tar, I went, I could feel every little rock.
Yeah, it was hard. Yeah.
I went, oh, what's going on here? You know, and they don't give you much time. So I got to the start, and to be even worse, there was a small group of factory guys there and a few supporters because of where the start point was. It wasn't huge. So they kind of lined us all up in grid rows. And I just got this shit look on my face, and Trevor Wilson was there, who was over to watch to go the following year.
Yeah.
And he's going, what's wrong, mate? I'm going, mate, I think I'm in for a bad day. I think I might have just cocked this right up.
Did you know at that point you'd overfilled?
Yeah, I knew that it was wrong.
Yeah, okay.
And I knew that there was nothing I could do about it. What I should have done was undone the bolt on the bottom of the fork leg if I could find a socket with a 17 mil or whatever on it and let some fluid out. Anyway, I went, the road wasn't that challenging, but I knew there was something wrong.
Mm.
So I've taken off down the beach and I just went, I'm just going to write today off. And just survive, you know. So I got down the beach, and as I come off the beach after about a 25 km run at full bickies down the beach, it was a right into a creek line to get off, and the first decent lip I hit coming off the beach, it just threw me straight over the bars.
Wow.
And I was
like, wow.
Fuck, that's not supposed to happen. Yeah. Picked myself up, kept going, and within the first 100 km of the day, I'd just flogged myself up, like trying to ride it. I got to the point I was that scared of hitting just little rocks in the road surface that I was having to watch where I was going. You know, and it was straight up and over a big rocky mountain range, and I just knew that I was burning time, and the cars caught me twice as quick as they were catching me on the other days.
Yeah.
And I got to the point on the mountain and I was pretty well screwed physically. And I went, I've just got to get some fluid out of these forks. So I took unscrewed the, you know, the air bleeder on top of the forks and just pumped the shit out of those forks, which of course I've got a face full of fork oil. I've got fork oil all over me, and it's all over my nav gear and all over the bike. And I went, and then I did it up again, and I ended up with about maybe 50 or 60% of normal fork travel.
Yeah.
Enough to get me through the day with oil all over me, and rectified it that night. And even then, I didn't have much time, and I didn't have enough time to take the fork out and get it to how it should have been. I just bled more fluid out and sucked it up. And
wow.
And it wasn't until... So I kind of had a good start to the rally, and then just that one thing just compounded everything. It made days longer. It made work at night harder, you know. And then it wasn't until the halfway rest day that I had time to take those forks out and service them properly under the guidance of a White Power factory guy. We pulled them down, replaced the fork seals, and back to how it should have been.
Yeah, right.
Right from the get-go.
It's like a whole new bike once you got it back.
Yeah, it was like having fun then.
and how was the subsequent days? Were you back to kind of day two, day three riding?
Yes, but yeah, I mean...
Fatigued, obviously, had set in and...
Yeah, and then, but you find yourself at altitude in Bolivia.
Right.
You know, and that was the next 2 days were at 4,500 metres. Yeah, right. And now the bike is performing so poorly that I couldn't, you know, in first gear, in the wet dunes that we were in, just dropping the clutch, I would actually have to run with my legs, you know, or get off and push the bike as well to get it to start to move.
Really?
Enough. Yeah. The bike was that down on power. It was phenomenal how much of a difference it made in that terrain on top of being sucking for air.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then still having a bit of altitude sickness.
That
was, you know, if it wasn't the altitude, the conditions, bikes, you know, there was a lot of people pulled out that day because they were suffering from the altitude, you know, and not so much just the altitude, but they put us in a physically challenging type of environment at the same time. It was a killer.
Yeah.
Were you teaming up with anyone at that point, or were you doing this pretty much by yourself?
It's just, you can't, unless you start the day as a pair and you're not finishing Dakar unless you both finish. All it does is fuck you around, you know. Like, I'm going to ride with you, you're having a good day, or you're having a good couple of hours, you're in a good space, you're going great, and then I'm busting my ass to try and keep up with you, or you're getting frustrated that you know, it's like you're sitting on the top of every dune going, fucking hurry up, you know, and then it flip flops. So you can't, you can pair up with somebody and you can say we'll ride together, but it's not a commitment.
No.
You know, it's, let's just get out of this dune system together.
Yeah.
You know? And then at a point, you just don't have the physical energy, you know, reserve to commit to helping somebody get a bike, you know, out of a dune. And...
Is there a degree of, I've committed 2 years of my life, a whole shit ton of money.
Yep.
I want to do as best I can. I don't want to be kind of potentially...
Held back.
I don't want to ride at your pace because, I don't want to be held back. I want to see what I push myself to my limit and see how much I can do. Or does that not, is it like a war of attrition at one point where you go, you know, I'm just going to help my mate through?
Yeah, I think most people commit to, I've done the hard work, I've done my work.
Yep.
I need to get to the finish, you know, to justify what I've put into it.
Yeah.
I'll help you, but, you know, at a point, I'm going to justify to myself, I'm going to get to the finish.
Yeah.
To help somebody and put yourself out, only to find you finished the special, like the special test, or the stage, or a split stage, you might get to a point where there's a cutoff, a time cutoff.
Oh, right.
It could be 3:30 in the afternoon, but they won't let you go into the second half of the stage because they don't want to recover you at night.
Yeah, right.
Leave you out there.
Yeah.
So if you, and you kind of don't have a hard feel for how much time you've got to play with.
Yeah.
There's plenty of people who have been so disappointed that they've towed somebody out only to miss the cutoff themselves to then not be allowed to move through, you know. You've got a language barrier to deal with to even push your point.
Yeah.
And they won't, you know, that's it. It's a safety thing.
Yeah.
So you've got to be really careful about how you play the game. And,
yeah.
It's yours. It's yours to play.
Yeah. I guess if you're doing a Malimoto too and you've gone over to do it, Malimoto, you're in that mindset where this is you. You're making this happen. I don't really need to rely on anyone else, otherwise I wouldn't have done it this way. I would have tried to team up earlier.
Yep.
You've gone to Dakar as Malimoto to finish Malimoto by yourself.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's a solo run the whole way. Doesn't mean you can't be, you can't have good ethics and help people where you get a chance. Yep. You know,
if they need some chicos, you just throw them as you go past. Yeah. I mean, that's the way. That's how you played the game.
Yeah, I stopped at a point. There's a guy on a quad. He waved me down. You know, and he was stuck halfway down this massive dune, and he buried the nose of it into a little, you know, a little dip, and just wasn't going to get it out himself. And I kind of went past, and I was at the bottom of this massive dune. I went, I'm going to go and give this guy a hand. I couldn't even get my bike up to him to help him. So I've actually parked my bike up maybe 150 metres from him.
Ooh, I'll be up a dune, down the bottom of a dune.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Well, halfway up it. And I've just stopped and parked my bike. And so then I've basically stripped down to just a T-shirt because I'm sucking for air to even get up to him, you know. Helped him get it out, and then, which took us about half an hour, you know, but even getting to him, it was like 15 minutes for me to climb this 200 metres of sand dune to get to him, and just physically.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so I'd done my part to help somebody else, so I was on the moral high ground, and if
good karma.
You know, if karma means anything, I'm in a good spot. I'm okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, we rolled off there, and I never saw him again. And,
yeah, okay.
You know, but... Yeah.
So that Peru was your highest point, altitude-wise?
Did you Bolivia.
Bolivia is the highest. Yep. Sorry, Bolivia, big pardon. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, and then from there, you gradually make your way back down to the finish.
Yeah, a massive roll down through a big valley in Liaison into Argentina.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, I just can't imagine. How many days?
14.
14.
14 days.
Yeah, 14 days.
Yep. So.
Yeah, 14 days.
Yeah, it was then. It changes a bit.
Yeah, and like, what did you take away from Dakar?
I guess a sense of achievement.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big goal. Like,
yeah,
it was 5 years worth of brain matter applied to it. It was 2 years worth of raising funds and putting it all together.
Yeah.
I came home with what I wanted, and that's a finish.
Yeah.
You know, came home disappointed that I know I could have finished in a better position if I'd had the perfect run, but very few people get the perfect run.
Yeah, I think Dakar and perfect run are not really in the same mix.
So you've got to let it go. Disappointment. The rally finishes and it's over. You know, the way the organisers finished that year was a horrible last stage of about 200 k's of dirt roads. You know, slowest person starts, so everybody's overtaken everybody.
Oh, okay.
So it's a dust fest, you know, and it's all about for the crowd. And it was just dangerous.
Yeah.
It was just super dangerous.
Right,
you
know? Okay.
It was massively dangerous. The guys at the guys that finish or that start that last stage last are the guys at the front of the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they give them half an hour to 45 minutes dust-free time before they start.
Set them off.
But for the rest of us, I'm just eating dust for 180 k's, having the crazy bastards in the group rip past you in dust, you know, and for no reason. You know, you're not going to make up other than the fast guys, if it's there to be made.
Yeah, the top kind of five guys could be fighting for a place, so they're going to be the ones pushing hard.
But then it was like, finish that, you know, a couple of 100K liaison back to your camp, clean your bike up. Okay, now now you've got to ride through the city to get to the finish podium. You know, you go to the finish podium and...
Rockstar again.
Nah, only the rock stars get the rock star treatment then. The rest of us, we didn't get to ride up the podium. But anyway, that's fine. But you park the bike there and then you've got to do all of the celebration things. Have a few beers. But then you've got to ride another hour and a half through the traffic back to the bivouac. And the next morning everybody's leaving.
Yeah, right.
And I didn't have the confidence to even book a flight home because I wasn't sure where I was going to be leaving from.
Yeah.
If I didn't get through Peru, why book a flight?
Yeah.
I didn't have the money to waste. So so I'm trying to jack it up the night before about how I'm going to get from the finish to where the bike gets put on a boat, which is 1,000 k's away.
Mm.
You know, it's a mad liaison through bloody Argentina. to Buenos Aires. So I'm trying to jack that up, and the race team came through with me that I'd used a little bit, Baz Dakar. So high fives, watch Toby, you know, gallop on the podium. Yeah. It was awesome. It was good. But I just couldn't relax and enjoy it.
Yeah,
and,
no, not
And
at
not
all.
Only that, I didn't have a flight home. I needed to sort myself out and leave in a truck at 4 o'clock that next morning, so I'd have my shit sorted. It's already 10:30 at night. Nobody there that I know either.
Yeah.
Like Mel Moto. There's nobody I knew.
No, no.
Rod Faggoter and Toby, those guys, but they're a part of a team, so they're, yeah, they're relaxing and enjoying things. The Mel Moto guys, there's probably only three of them that speak English.
Yeah, okay.
And everybody's tired, you're exhausted. Yeah, you're fatigued.
Everybody's. I even had to bum a room in a hotel off one of the other French guys that was doing Mel Moto with me, and said, you know, can I bunk up with you because there's no hotels to line up.
Right.
And in the end, I spent 2 hours in the hotel room and had to go back and then, you know, they didn't even have a seat for me in the truck. They jammed me in like a sleeper bunker, locked me in. I had to crawl in between all the, you know, spare oil and all that sort of shit. And
was it more of a journey, bloody, getting back?
Yeah, yeah. It was like a 14-hour truck drive across Argentina.
Yeah.
And I'm at least horizontal and
yeah.
and just shut down. I reckon I slept about 12 of that.
Yeah. Really?
You know, yeah. Just, every time they stopped for spent. Fuel, they'd throw a bottle of water at me and that was it.
Yeah.
It was like, fucking. Yeah. So, yeah, that's the worst. The hardest part about my Dakar, I suppose, was not getting to enjoy it at the end.
Yeah.
You know, by the time I'd got back to Australia, I had decompressed to a degree, but didn't have a chance to celebrate. And then you get home and it's...
Straight back into the farm.
Straight back into getting on the mower and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird way to think of it, isn't it? You've just completed one of the hardest races that we have on motorcycles, and you were just, everybody's out there celebrating, having a good time, like reminiscing, and you're like, okay, I need a hotel room, I need to get my bike back, yeah, I need to fly back, okay, I'm back in Australia, now I've got to mow the lawn, then I've got to go jab a horse in the neck with some fucking drugs to make it breed. Yeah. I don't know what the hell you guys were doing before. Yeah, but
and try and put the 12 kilos that I lost back on.
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
Spend some time with us.
Yeah, we'll help you fatten up, don't you worry about that.
I don't need your help.
What did you learn from that? Like, you've got aspirations to go again?
I do, mate.
Yeah.
So much. Just having seen it and knowing what to expect. I think I'll just prepare the bike no differently.
Okay, so the bike, that side of it was good?
Yeah, it was.
Yep. Use the same bike or did you buy a new one?
Well, actually, I've got a brand new spare engine sitting in my garage for it. So it's hard to justify buying the newer, sexier version when I've got a bike that would be ready to go.
Ready to go.
And it would be... It's all about the engine. If the engine's in good shape, the rest of the bike, you know...
All serviceable.
It's all chassis-wise, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, bearings and shit are replaceable, and I would do all of that. So, no, I've committed the purchase for the bike. It's half the cost, you know, so I'm happy to ride an older bike, you know, fully refurbished with a brand-new engine, and I'll go again.
Yeah. When do you think that'll be?
Well, it was going to be in January.
Yeah, yeah.
Has
there been talk about what's happening? I mean,
it's going ahead.
It is going ahead, is it?
Yeah. Andrew Houlihan and Michael Birch is they're heading over.
Yep. Okay. So I was going to go, but as soon as COVID kicked off, it was a bit of a reality check for one. Couldn't be assured financially that we're gonna float through unchallenged.
Yeah.
And then my wife did remind me that we did put off the house renovations for me to go to Dakar the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Renovations are ongoing as we speak.
Yeah.
But it's still, I just didn't want to commit to it. You know, like it's a long commitment, including training, riding, preparing and all that sort of stuff. So it's a good 6 or 8 months out minimum. And at that point I wasn't in a position
to commit.
So, you know, I haven't had a chance to ride this year. Let it go.
Yeah.
You know, and try and line up
the following.
And my only reason for going, I'd like to do better next time, but probably the key appeal to go back and have another crack at Dakar is it's in a different place, a different part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'll go there and it'll be a true desert rally.
Yeah.
They always made it work in South America.
Yeah.
But it was little patches of desert here and there. You know, you go to the Middle East, the whole country's a desert.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So you're in a real environment that you don't get a chance to break away from.
Yeah.
You know. So that has an appeal.
Yeah. Would you go Mallee Matto again?
Oh, I don't think I'll ever do anything but.
No. Okay.
Yeah. The rest is an easier run.
Uh-huh.
There's more assurances that you're going to finish.
Yep.
I just like the appeal.
Yeah. Okay.
If I could, I'd take it back to. Yes, I've done Mallee Matto. It is still supported by the event organisers to a degree. You know, I wasn't born at the right time. If you go back to the way Dakar was originally, you're carrying everything on your back.
Yeah.
You know, your bike needs to be just that bit better than even Mallee Matto.
Yeah.
And you're sleeping on the ground in a dust storm.
Yeah.
There's no motorhomes and shit around to be seen.
No woolly hand warmers for the...
Yeah, I think it just levels the field a little bit, and that's the way I like to roll.
Yeah.
So
I think for anybody to be wanting to go back to the old times, it'd be you, mate. The way you ride around here, I think it's you'd be the perfect candidate to go do those kind of crazy races.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah.
And that's where my challenge is.
To be honest, I've always thought it'd be great to see what Dakar would be like if we stripped teams away, just let the top riders do Mallee Matto and see exactly how good they are.
Because
I think that's the challenge. Like, we've spoken to James Ferguson, who's done Mallee Matto as well. Like, the challenge is like preserving your bike, preserving your body all the way through and planning. Whereas, not to take away from the fast guys are fast and they are still our heroes. So, Price, we love you. But like, they just have to worry about one day getting to the end and then that's it. The bike goes away. They can go do, like, they don't have to worry about that longevity of the bike because they've got a team there to replace stuff and do whatever. Whereas you are like smashing your day out, but then you're like, okay, now I've got to wait because I've got three more days ahead of me before the halfway point where I can then change the brakes. So if I'm hard on the brakes today, I've got to then manage them tomorrow and things like that.
Yeah, it's probably not quite how you've explained it.
No, not at all.
But full credit to those guys that they're in a different world, you know. They are pushing the limits of safety the whole way, going hard. But what it means for them is they're riding on track that isn't chopped up. They're not burning the same calories. And they're out there for half the time. Like, if you look at Toby's ride day compared to mine, the time he leaves the bivouac to the time he finishes, within the stage where it's taxing, is half the time.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's half the time. Those guys are not having to line up with 150 other bikes to refuel at a bullshit point in the middle that, you know, if you step off your bike just to have a piss, you lose your line, you lose your spot in the line. Then there's 20 minutes when those quads are just pushing in to that refuel point, and that's just making your day longer.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and it's just time you stand around dehydrating, burning calories. So, yeah, hats off to how they roll at the front, but it is a different game.
Yeah.
And they all appreciate it too. Like, they'll often have a day where, you know, if they have a bad day and they have to start back in the field, they know what it's like to ride a chopped up track and how much harder it is than the way the race presents itself for them normally. So they know what it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is a different world.
Yeah. So what's left on the bucket list? Obviously, Dakar again. Any, like, Fink, any of those kind of local races that you'd look at doing?
Eco-Africa,
It's getting close to 50, mate. I'll focus on the big ones.
Okay.
Righto. Yeah, yeah. Fink is very unique.
Yep.
Fink is a lot of time and effort for 5 hours worth of ride time, or six or 7 hours worth of ride time.
You'd do it there and back in like in 6 hours, wouldn't you, mate? That's your challenge.
I don't know about that. having not ridden it, I can't pass judgment, but it's the time and effort required to get there for such a short amount of
time. That's probably
a challenging time.
Yeah.
My projects tend to be a bit bigger than that.
Yeah.
Which means I like to get a little bit more ride time than that. And I just haven't got it in my life to do it right. And doing it right requires going out there a few times during the year and
pre-runs and knowing
the terrain and being fit for that terrain.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose getting a bike set up as well for it, because the bikes you have, I mean, you could do it on the rally bike. I mean, that'd be spectacular, but it's a bit of a waste of the bike.
Correct. Yeah, I just haven't got the time to commit that month's worth of my energy to get out there and do it right.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd much rather be, while everybody's at Fink, I'd much rather be belting, doing, having another crack at the double
crossing,
double of the Simpson or something like that. You know, that's, I don't know, it doesn't have to be unique too much, but I suppose it is something that's a little different.
A little different, and,
not everybody's going to go on it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So, very good reason for it, but no.
Other than that, mate, what's next? I guess I'll have another crack at Dakar.
Yep. Well,
that is in the plans. Yep. You know, if everything lines up, nothing happens in between. Kind of drawing boards clean on that, look, I've had to cancel two tours in Mongolia, and I would really love to get back there.
Yeah.
And explore. And take people over.
Yeah. Okay. You
know, I'm happy to have been quoted that I'm not interested in becoming a tour operator here in Australia. Mm. But I do like the concept of taking people over to somewhere like that, going through all the logistics challenges and that sort of thing, and getting to share a ride in an environment that is magic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There are some good places around the world, but Mongolia is just, it's a place that I've been, so I'm comfortable there.
Right.
It's safe to ride. There is no land ownership in Mongolia.
Right.
There are no gates. There are no fences. There's nobody saying, what are you doing on my piece of land?
Yeah.
It's, fuck.
Yeah.
You just come over that hill.
Yeah.
Where did you come from? Where are you going? Yeah. Here, have a drink. Here, have something to eat.
Wow.
Can my kids sit on your motorbike? You know? Yep. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool.
Keep rolling. It's just phenomenal country.
Yeah.
You know?
But you got that experience because of Moto Nomad 2.
Yes.
That's where that was your first trip to Mongolia?
Yeah, mate. Yep.
Yeah. And so what is Moto Nomad 2?
So it was a movie that Adam Riemann put together.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously the sequel to his Moto Nomad 1, where he went from the KTM factory all the way to the pyramids in Egypt. Two guys running together, no support, on bikes. So his next evolution of that was what I was involved in. And it was an opportunity to run the same model with three of us to carry some more film gear and bounce through a different part of the world.
And so how did you get involved with that?
So I used to race with and against Adam in WA, in the state level enduro and a few Pony Expresses and that sort of thing. And I bumped into him probably 10 years later after having not been in contact at all. I just bumped into him at a motorcycle show down in Melbourne. I was down there, you know, with my rally after having done the double crossing and got asked to be on a stand. Bumped into him then, had a quick conversation, and I mentioned that I was sort of keen to focus on going to Dakar. And I guess he knew my background, and he sort of went, well, I've probably got something that might help raise your profile. If you're interested, you could bring something to the party. How does a, you know, 9,000K, 10,000K ride across, you know, Kazakhstan, Russia, and Mongolia. So, and I went, oh, hang on, let me think.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I will take some long service leave to do that.
Yeah, right.
So, what did I bring to the party on that? The second rider. But we built the bikes here in the garage.
Oh, right. Really?
Was it here?
Yeah. So we put them all together here. KTM Australia put the bikes up.
What did you use?
Brand new KTM 500s.
Yep.
So Adam did the fiberglass work up the front, and I sat in there on a sewing machine and built the panniers and stuff. And we put them together and boxed them up and sent them over to Kazakhstan.
Yeah, well.
Flew in and rode. So was it?
It's a great movie. Like, both of these movies and all the stuff that he does online.
Yeah, full credit.
Motology. Motology. Yep. Yeah. He does just absolutely awesome stuff. But that movie was really cool. And
that's full credit to him.
Yeah,
I was just there to enjoy the ride and to carry a camera and support him. Be the second rider, I suppose.
Be the muscle.
If it was needed. it was.
Yeah, you're the one riding the hilltops with your little your night vision goggles, just making sure they're safe
clear
down the
track. No sleep for me. It was good. It was a ripper. That part of the world was new to me, and yeah, it was just it was good times. We had a few challenges, but
what was the route? I'm just trying to think. You've just mentioned those countries, so Kazakhstan.
Yep.
Then into Russia.
Yeah. So. So probably middle of Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
All the way across Kazakhstan, up into Russia.
Up here. Yeah.
You know, we're talking about the eastern half of Russia. So we're already into southern Siberia.
Yep.
You go across the border. We went up further than we needed to because it was the only place we could find a rep for the oil that was sponsoring us.
Okay.
So we went about 600 k's further into Russia than we needed to do an oil change.
Yeah, well.
Carry some extra oil from there and then sort of went through that southern Siberia. Which is old Russia. I guess we can term it whatever you like.
Yeah.
But the guys in that part of Russia have nothing to do with the Kremlin.
Okay.
You know, we're talking peasant part of Russia right. where, you know, where bears still eat people. And,
yeah, okay.
People you know, still eat bears.
Yeah. And anyway, yeah. It was a good place. Like, the people were very... we're very friendly,
yep,
and so far away from that part of their own
from Russia,
Russia that they're living a different life,
yeah,
you know, a bit of a peasantry life, and it was awesome to sort of experience that, and then roll down through into what is, I guess, almost the most westerly part of Mongolia,
mm-hmm.
and rode all the way across Mongolia,
yeah,
so.
That's epic. On 500s too. So like just enduro bikes, not even your adventure bikes.
With a fistful of spares and that was it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, how'd you find that doing all this on your adventure bike? How'd you go going onto an enduro bike and doing such big Ks?
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah?
Yep. Yep. After about the first week, you know, your ass gets used to that skinny little seat.
Yeah, okay.
And
how long did it take you? What was that?
What are we there? 6 weeks?
6 weeks to do that.
6 weeks to do 9,500 Ks. Yeah.
You were like, I could do it in like 35 hours. Move out of the way.
Yeah. No, it was good to... It was a good travel model.
Yeah.
You know? We just covered some big miles and sort of did some filming along the way. And Adam had a plan there and that was super slick. You know, I had a camera on my back with a quick zip on top. So he'd give the word to stop. I'd pull up. I wouldn't even get off my bike. He'd get off, reach in, grab the tripod and the camera, set it up, and you know we'd go back a couple hundred meters on the track. So I think full credit to the way Adam thinks and the way he rolls there is nothing staged, Rhino. Yes, we might have ridden through that piece of ground before, but you know when a bloke falls off or you know you're doing it's all how it is. It's the first time roll. It's not, that didn't work out.
Probably. Go back and do it again.
Go back and do it again.
That didn't look too good, so go back and fall better.
Yeah, or more to the point, let's just go over there and look at that terrain and, you know, we'll film ourselves going through that valley and then we'll get back on track and go somewhere else. We were riding through all that terrain the first time. It was good.
Yeah. So that was, you obviously wanted to get, not publicity, but a profile that, helped you gain that to
arguably yes and no, you know, it didn't. Yes, it did.
Yeah.
And I guess I've run into people who know my name as a result of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, the mindset of that helping get sponsorship and support for Dakar.
Yeah. Okay.
It did. It didn't pan out that way.
Right.
Just through how. You know, I would have thought that in the motorcycle industry that might have.
Yeah,
got me a little, you know, might have helped.
Yeah. Met some industry people.
You guys would know. You talk to enough people that the motorcycle industry is the hardest place for a motorcyclist to get money from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to get support.
Yeah,
you might get a helmet here or a pair of boots there, but that's when you want to go and do big things. It's cold hard cash that's going to make it happen or not.
Yeah, and gloves don't fill the fuel tank up.
No, and I think where all the money is in the industry is in conglomerates and floated bloody stocks on the market and that kind of thing and those people, those organisations, they don't like giving the money away. No. If they're going to give it to anybody, it's the shareholder.
Yep.
And if they're going to give away a dollar for advertising, they want $1.20 back.
Yep.
You know, so I can't give that back.
No.
You know, so that was a really hard learning curve on thinking how I was going to achieve Dakar. You know, we'll just go out and ask the right people and get some money through the industry, some support, equipment and all that sort of stuff. And the reality is, the horse community got behind me more than the motorcycle industry.
Is that right?
Really?
Yeah, we ran a fundraiser here one night, and you know, the philanthropic people amongst the crew bought stuff, you know. Yeah. But yeah, other than that, it was people who were either going to pay the tax man or provide a little bit of sponsorship dollar to get me there. Mm. You know, otherwise I've given it away anyway.
Mm.
It's not the motorbike industry, unless you're Toby or somebody like that, you know.
Yeah,
and they're giving them a mad return for
what they can offer. I guess you're buying a name with Toby Price, aren't you?
Yep. Yeah. So thinking you're going to run a raffle on the weekends a couple of times.
Mm.
Me personally, my recommendation for somebody in my position, just do an extra hour, an extra shift
once a week. You know, that's...
take on the weekend work.
Yeah.
Make it even harder to train.
But
over the space of a year or two, you're going to put more money away that way than you're going to get by spending all of your energy trying to be nice to the right people and trying to line those people up to support you.
Yeah, right.
They're that's all interested. Advice. The whole industry is mad keen, full of support, but it doesn't turn into dollars on the table.
Yeah, right.
You know, unless you're far better at it than I am. Full credit if you are.
No, I think I've got an automotive background, and the impression is that they've got so much money. Look at the showrooms, look at their cars, look at all the people. But they are tighter than a shark's. You know what? They just don't want to spend money.
A little sticker on your motorbike on the other side of the world in an event that doesn't get that much publicity.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know,
we can give you a Dirt Bike Breeder sticker and give you a dollar.
I would $2. Happily take it.
Wait,
dollar for you, dollar for me.
Oh, good, okay. Whew, I was like, jeez, I don't have two.
Can you give me three just so I know that you've given me a dollar more than Ben?
Yeah, done.
Okay, done. Sorry, Benny.
Suck it up, Benny.
I got it in my pocket.
We'll give it on the way. Look, there's only really one more thing. Honestly, we could talk to you for hours. We're going to have
busted
sucked
the
up.
Budget.
Oh, yeah. We can't afford you any longer. Unfortunately. That's what it is now, mate. We've run out of money.
We're square at the moment because you've helped me inject a horse.
We were talking about horse sperm before, so you can't be talking about injecting a horse sperm. Yeah. Like, come on. Simpson crash. We mentioned it before in the air jacket. Let's dive into that bad boy.
Yeah. Shit, that was leading into Dakar. I had this man plan of... It was a plan anyway, but I had a mad plan to sort of do another profile thing. I've got a desire to achieve a double crossing of the Simpson.
So what does that mean?
That means starting at either Birdsville or Mount Deere and punching all the way across, refueling and going back in a straight shot. So...
you said 7 hours for one crossing, so 15...
Eight, yeah, a bit under eight.
Okay, so under 20 hours would be your goal?
Yeah. Originally, when I went out to do this, it was to achieve it in a 24-hour period.
Yeah, okay.
Just a straight shot.
Yeah.
Try and beat that, Greg Jaeger.
It's there. There's a record there. Some guys have done it.
Yeah.
No dramas. So for me, it was, you know, go out there with the intent of punching it as hard as I could.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I did get across in under 8 hours.
Yeah.
Refueled and could taste the steak back in the Birdsville's.
Yeah.
You know, Birdsville pub a little bit early. Yeah. And, I was coming past Dalhousie Springs and was at a point where you're not in the dunes, you're on the hard pack on the far side, and I had 42 litres of fuel on board in bladders hanging off the side of the bike, and I was just sitting down to conserve some energy, and I was making the most of the less technical terrain, and come around this mad sweeper, and at about 140 k's an hour in a national park, but we'll keep that to ourselves.
Yeah.
and there was nothing but water on the road in front, like it was a little channeled road, and it was just a big pool of water. And I kind of hit the brakes, and there was an option there off to the right that I would have picked no dramas and had washed off enough speed, but there was a dirty big dry pothole between me and the water. And because I was hard on the brakes, the front suspension was compressed. Yeah. And I hit it, and the front soaked it up, but then when the back hit it, because I was so light on the back end, it put me into a forward cartwheel at 100 and... probably about 120 k's an hour, and the bike just it cartwheeled for 100 metres, and I went 50, and I remember going over the bars going, fuck, this is not good.
Yeah.
And 10 minutes before that, I had stopped for a piss and got off my bike, and I had an air jacket on, and because I had an air jacket on, I didn't have any other protection. You know, I was relying on the air jacket doing its job. When I got off for a piss, I disconnected the lanyard that sets it off. Forgot to put it back on.
Fuck.
So I had no protection when I went over the bars. Jesus. The air jacket didn't do its job because it wasn't hooked up to do so, but the worst part was when I went over the bars, I ragdolled it straight into the ground, and the gas canister that sets off the air jacket sits at a spot, and it broke 10 of my ribs.
Oh,
of course, because it would have encapsulated it when it went off.
It just caved in. Yeah, it is. That's protected by its own edge, by its own air, implosion when it's supposed to happen. So I ended up with 10 broken ribs in multiple places, bruised my liver, punctured a lung, fractured some vertebrae in my neck, and tore the collarbone clean off the top of my shoulder. So I sort of came to, and I was on my back in the middle of the track when I came to, nobody else there. And I remember it took me like 5 minutes to be able to roll over on a shoulder that wasn't working, and get on my hand and knees, and to be able to get up. And you know, I look down the road and there's just bike parts everywhere. And
it's a garage sale.
So it was. I took my helmet off and, you know, wandered on down to the motorbike because I had a sat phone on the bike.
Oh yeah.
And I had a spot beacon on there as well, but I didn't hit the button on the beacon. I pulled the sat phone out and set it up and called my wife and said, who was giving a lesson in this very shed just here. When she took the phone call, she goes, "He shouldn't be calling me now." And it was from an odd number. Yeah. It was a satellite number. And so she took the phone call and I said, "Oh, look, I had a bit of an accident.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in a bad way. I'm not sure where I am sort of thing, but I'm alive."
Yeah.
And then the phone went dead. And the phone went dead because I'd never charged it properly.
Fuck.
So I had that one call. It cut out before we had a chance to coordinate anything. And she's pretty sharp. So she dialed 000.
Right.
Buddy. And because I had the spot beacon on, she could give an accurate grid reference.
Yeah, okay.
So she activated it, and then, you know, so I'm sitting there looking at this bloody dead phone and on the side of the track, a little bit worse for wear. And I was probably only there for about 25 minutes, going into a bit of self-help, make myself comfortable, and a four-wheel drive turns up, a couple of guys in it. There was another couple in another one behind them. You know, they stayed with me the whole time, to be honest, but I was there for about 4.5 hours.
Wow.
They had a sat phone. They called 000 and then called the RFS, with speaking to them direct. And the RFS didn't know whether to send a chopper out from Alice or, you know, get the plane up from Port Augusta because there was rain in the area and they were worried about sending a plane to the nearest strip that could that could have rain but after they launch. And so they pissed around for a while, rightly so.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting there just waiting for an answer back, and then old Jono turns up in a Land Cruiser Ute, tray back. He goes, "G'day, fellas, I'm the standby Parks and Wildlife guy from..." He goes, I'm your ambulance." He had like a single bed mattress in the back of this Land Cruiser Ute. He goes, "Jump in." I go, "Mate, if I can't lay down on that. I've got that many things broken and I'm, you know, I'm hurting here.
Yeah.
There's no possible way I can lay down, let alone in the back of a bouncing ute."
And then you drive me back.
And going, "So it's just not going to work." Anyway, the guys, so the two guys that have been with me, they picked my bike up and they wheeled it into the bush and put it behind a salt bush. You know, it's a pretty rare bike to be left alone in the bush. Anyway, so
bike was this on you?
This is my 690 Rally.
Oh.
So they punt.
Oh no.
Just tucked it in the bush. I didn't care at that point.
Yeah.
I just said, "I'll just put it in the bush and just take a grid reference and we'll sort it out." Anyway, I sat in the front of this Land Cruiser troopy with these guys, and he just said, "Follow me. I'll take you back to the hangar and we'll sort it out." And we're waiting for the guys to drive up from in South Australia, a medic, you know, a couple of medics. And the plane's on its way.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there holding the shit strap on the front of a troopy in the passenger seat, and we're driving, and this guy in the Land Cruiser Ute is driving, and because my driver's like sitting right up his ass, he's thinking, "Well, fuck, they're good to go. I'll just speed up. We'll get there." So we're like doing rally driving all the way back.
With 10 broken rims.
Going, "Fucking hell, mate, just take it easy. Just, you know." So one's thinking, "Oh, I need to keep up." The other one's thinking,
"I've got to get there. Let's go.
I can keep going." So I get there, and And in the end, yeah, I just held on and sucked it up. And we get there, and this angry female nurse from had turned up 3.5 hours of driving through mud to get to us. And, you know, she takes my vitals and shit. I've got a punctured lung, so I'm coughing up a bit of blood and stuff. And she's going, yeah. So she rang up and got approval to give me morphine, but put me in a neck brace straight away, which is probably fair. But before she did that, she basically cut all my clothes off. So I'm sitting there if you've never been to Dalhousie, it's like natural springs, thermal springs. There wouldn't be a day in the year that there isn't like a million mosquitoes there because there's so much moisture. So I'm laying there on this table with no strides on, no clothes, and I can just feel the mosquitoes just
pick up and carry away.
And I know because of the broken ribs and a dodgy shoulder, there's no way I'm going to be able to scratch these fucking things for the next few weeks. Don't move. I can just feel them bite me.
What an experience. You know?
Yeah, so 12 hours from crash to hospital.
Right.
Wow, 12 so, hours.
Yeah.
And then surgery on your broken vertebrae?
Not on the vertebrae.
Shoulder.
In my neck, but the shoulder, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, and shitload of x-rays. I spent a week in hospital. Yeah.
Which hospital? Where did you get to? Oh, you went to Adelaide.
They took me to Adelaide. They bounced me to do a refuel in Port Augusta of the plane and then take me to Adelaide. And then my wife said, because we've got one of our clients here, her husband's a clavicle specialist down on the coast, and I'm loaded up with morphine. She goes, do not get the operation in Adelaide. Do not get the operation in Adelaide. And, you know, on 3 days, even better part of the story, I had planned to do this double crossing while I was still in the army. On my farewell in Sydney, I come home on the train and my appendix ruptured. Coming home, not that I was on the piss, but so I had to delay this ride 2 weeks to have my appendix out and for those little stitches to heal up.
Yeah.
And then I went out 2 weeks after my appendix was taken out to do this ride, which meant that I was clear of the army by like 3 days.
So I
no longer have the medical support and the rehab and the insurances and everything that after 23 years of being in the army. Now I'm 3 days a civilian and
you're
I'm in the hospital.
Own.
Yeah.
So...
costing an arm and a leg. Yeah.
Well, I had private cover. It was the only thing I sorted out before
that's
I went.
Good. Yeah.
But anyway, I never used it. I was in a public hospital.
Yeah.
And because of the morphine, I didn't listen to her. And you know, the surgeons are around. And they're probably trainee surgeons.
Yeah.
Going, oh, yeah, no, we can do it here. It's easy. Went, fuck. Well, I'm here. I'm already on morphine.
Yeah, might as well.
Just do it. So she made me pay anyway. So I was there for nearly a week. She had a competition on the weekend. She said, well, you can fucking wait until I finish the competition. So on a Sunday afternoon, she finished competing, drove to Canberra, flew down, had a hire car, and by then, the hospital had already kicked me out.
Yeah.
So I spent the first day and a half in Adelaide after coming out of hospital in a hotel room waiting for her to turn up. She lands there, gets a few hours sleep, and then I've got 14-hour drive sitting in a car with 10 broken ribs just to get home. So...
and a wife who's like,
yeah,
steaming.
There's no share in the driving.
But the more important question is the bike all right?
$26,000 repair bill.
Oh,
how much was the recovery bill though to retrieve it?
Oh, $1,500. I don't know. I don't remember because it came in as part of the insurance.
Oh, that's all right then. Yeah, okay.
Mate, I had it fully insured, but it was absolutely a write off based on the value of repair.
Yeah,
and I talked the insurance guy from Shannon's into. One, allowing me to not write it off.
Yeah.
Two, paying me the money to repair it.
Yeah, okay.
And I went through and I did it, you know, I did it right and repaired it myself. Rebuilt it, yeah. It was only because of the cost of rally parts. It's just phenomenally expensive and it was an obsolete bike at the time. And yeah, it was massive. But
wow.
It took a while to... It took it about 6 or 8 weeks to get home, but...
Yeah.
I wasn't in a state to be in a hurry for it to come.
You weren't going to pushing it anywhere.
Yeah, which was term of events, we had to get the guy out from Mount Dare to pick the bike up out of the desert, take it back to Mount Dare, to then wait for his next fuel run up to Alice. Went into the bike shop at Alice, they did the appraisal and everything, and it's like, well, how do we get it home from there? You know, some other friends were travelling through supporting another adventure bike ride.
Yeah.
It goes from there to Brisbane, and then, you know, and then it goes on a bike transport, so, you know... It,
It took its time to get back.
I
guess it's also it's completely destroyed too. It probably doesn't roll easily. Like it was
correct.
It was it's not like you just roll it on, roll off kind of thing. He's got to collect the box of parts that go on the bike and then slide the bike up onto the track.
The skull dragon.
And in reality, all the key components were fine, like the frame.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the swing arm, the forks, the triple clamps, and that. They were all good. It was just the bars and all that expensive nav tower up the front. And the. You know, the arse end of the bike had been torn off, and the threads holding those big plastic rear tanks on and that were torn out.
Pulled out.
You did a goodie.
Yeah, that was...
Is that the biggest crash you've
ever had?
That.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I'm totally okay with that, because when you ride the line, you know, at some point...
You're gonna cross
at some
it.
Point, you're going to pay. I mean, I've listened to a few of your podcasts.
I'm so sorry. Know,
Todd and that's good. Todd and Jake, anybody who plays the game, pays the price at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Toby, everybody, probably Rod Fagata.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what sport you're in. If it's if there's risk of serious injury, and you're in the game long enough, and you're pushing hard enough.
You're pushing, yeah.
Well, I think that's you're right. When you're pushing hard enough, that's when you get you step it up that next level. You're going to hurt yourself. I mean, even Alex. I mean, you went through four broken ribs, didn't you?
Five broken ribs, punctured lung, and it was. I'm not joking. It was a stationary crash. I fell at a point I shouldn't have fallen, but
yeah.
Cool, mate. To do 10 and shoulder and neck and liver, mate. That's terrifying.
If you're going to do it, you know, do it well.
If you're going to do it, you might as well do it in the middle of nowhere too.
Yeah.
On your own.
Yeah, which is what you like to do, mate.
It's one of those things that... So you didn't connect the vest.
Yeah.
Your sat phone wasn't charged.
Yeah.
Like, of all the things that could have happened...
Oh, shit, I've just admitted that I'm fallible. Yeah, my planning isn't quite as good as it should be. Sometimes you just got to fucking roll with it.
Yeah.
You did. You literally did.
I literally ragdolled it. Yeah.
Was it like a lawn dart into the floor as well? Or was it like just ass over a fucking head?
Probably don't remember, do
you? Mate, I think it was like a sack of potatoes. You know, like when the back end of the bike comes up, you get a little bit of elevation off the top of the bike.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's not just falling off the side, launched from, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 feet in the air. Yeah. And then
at 120.
Yeah, and then when you bite there, you don't sort of roll. You land like a sack of turd.
Yeah.
And then
Photos put up from the Goldfields ride. I'm just trying to find it.
I saw that on Facebook the other day.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Was it like that? I'm just trying to find it.
That's exactly how it would have started.
I'm just trying to find where it was. I can't remember. But it was brutal. Like, absolutely brutal.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a series of about 3 photos.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Got it. Yeah. I felt for him.
Yeah.
We all felt for him. Yeah. There it is, from the Kalgoorlie Desert Race.
Yep. So speed involved.
Yeah, like that photo. There's a photo there.
Yeah, like he's well off the ground already.
Yeah.
You know,
just
absolute. And then like we'll try and post them up.
Yep,
because they are absolutely crazy
I just
photos.
Cringe looking at that.
And then the bike's just gonna drive you into the ground.
Yeah,
for good measure.
And that's what you did.
Yep,
you did it well.
Yeah. I'm still here today.
Yeah, that's it. And you're ready to go.
Ready to line up for something else.
Ready to mow lawns and inject horses.
And maybe ride sometime next year.
Yeah.
Look, mate, we can't thank you enough, Scotty. You've been absolutely awesome, mate.
No problem.
Your stories are awesome. Look, we really wish we could hang out and keep talking, but we've taken away too much of your time already.
Yeah, no worries. Appreciate it. Happy to play.
We'll let's try and catch up with you next time you do a double or you go to Dakar. We'll catch up and sit up with you again. And I reckon you've got a fair amount more stories to go through.
Yeah, there's more of life to live, so there's going to be some stories there.
Absolutely. Yeah. But look, thank you very much for your time. We do have 3 questions, though, that Alex loves asking because he's so good at it now.
Yeah, well...
They were called the burrito trio, mate. Not rapid fire, so you can have a quick think about it, but Alex, what are they?
The 3 questions. The first one is any music that you listen to, either pre-event or post-event, to pump yourself up or to... Do you want to listen to when you're doing these
I'm
crossings?
I'm tone deaf, mate.
Okay.
The music going on in my mind.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, I don't...
Listen to the bike?
No, a week across Australia and back with no tunes.
No tunes.
Wow,
no.
Not a single tune. Just podcasts. Good quality podcasts.
I'm very guilty of being able to drive from one side of the country to the other with the same CD in the car.
Yeah.
And not even realise that it's going over
and
over again.
Wow, that's so
impressive.
Actually,
you know what? I sold a car. I owned a car for about 6 years. And when I sold it, I pulled the CD out and realised it was the same CD in the car for 6 years.
Yeah. So, no, music.
What's a CD?
Music's,
Oh, it shows my age, mate. It wasn't a cassette, at least.
Yeah. So no music, nothing at all.
Nah, it's not important to me.
Good on you.
It's just clouds my mind. I've got shit to think about.
Yeah.
Good on you.
You're calculating time routes. To distances and fuel burns and
correct.
Yeah.
I've tried it.
Yeah.
I'm used to riding rally bikes and they're too bloody loud and you can't hear the shit anyway.
Yeah. I reckon the second question, you probably answered both the next questions, but we'll cover them off. Your most embarrassing crash. Now, we've heard about your worst crash. Have you had an embarrassing crash?
No, not that I remember.
Okay.
No.
Most embarrassing injury. Not even from bikes. Just some injury that you've got and you're like, how the hell did that happen? Like,
can't think of anything.
You are one tough motherfucker. Jesus.
Look at this guy. I'm just trying to think. Who was it yesterday we're talking to that he was doing a transmotor race event and the guy got off his bike. It's a relay event and the guy got off, had the clutch on. He swung his leg over and twisted the throttle and he let the clutch go. And both the guys are chasing the bike down the pit.
Like cliffhanger down
not necessarily a crash.
Yeah.
The third one is we call it a golden ticket race. So any event around the world, not necessarily bikes, can be cars, buggies, quads, that is fully funded, fully supported by Mr. Moneybags.
Mr. Alex Ball.
No.
Mr. Red Bull.
Oh, look, I would think the Africa Eco Race.
Yeah, okay.
That's one of yours, mate, isn't it?
That's mine.
It's just another totally different environment, different countries, different challenges there that is equal to Dakar in most ways other than publicity.
Yeah.
And plus it's the original Dakar too.
Exactly.
From the era that you wanted to ride.
Correct. I think I could ride it. In that style,
mm-hmm.
Be responsible. Just have, not even have a spare set of wheels, really. You know, just I'd have them. Trust me, I'm not going to waste my money to go there or not.
Yeah.
I say, whoa, man.
Particularly if Jono's paying for it.
Yeah.
So, but no, that'd be it.
Yeah. Okay.
Silkway Rally or anything? Because you've already been up through that kind of area.
Had thought about it, but
money wise, you got all the money in the world if you're going to do it. And there's a golden ticket, so
yeah,
Silkway, because Silkway's priced way more than Dakar and all those kind of things.
True.
So,
close to it. I think about the same.
Yeah, but
for less riding and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Silkway. No, it'd be Africa. You go race, mate.
Okay.
On
a bike.
Always.
On a boys. Okay.
While my body's capable of doing it.
Yeah.
The extreme enduro type of events and that sort of thing. Because of my age, I'm kidding myself going there.
Yeah. You know,
I think my best riding's well and truly gone.
Right.
So. Stick with where I'm at there.
Yeah, cool. Awesome.
Unless that budget goes into taking years off and can turn me back into being 25.
Yeah.
The $1 million man. We can make him better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just made of metal and hope. That's what we need to be made of.
Yeah.
Right. Well, mate, it's an honour to sit down and talk with you, and not only about your bike riding career, but your military career. So, mate, thanks for your time. It's been terrific.
No worries. Pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Good times.
Now that's it. Usually we finish here, but I would just like to do a quick shout out to our previous guest, Andrew Houlihan, and another massive supporter of the podcast, Michael Burgess. They are both heading off to do the 2021 Dakar, and we wish them all the best. Make sure you go over and follow them on their social media pages to keep up to date with their progress. I know we're definitely catching up with them after, and we are very, very excited to say if you check out Andrew Houlihan's motorcycle, a little Dirt Bike Burrito sticker may be on the side of that. So make sure you go check them out. Good luck to everyone in the 2021 Dakar. Let's hope for a great, safe race. And we look forward to keeping up to date with the race as it goes. So once again, thank you so much, Scotty, for your epic stories. Thank you, the fans, for listening to these stories. Thank you, Alex, for being a part. Enjoy your Christmas. Enjoy your New Year's. Keep riding and stay safe.